back with episode 631 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and oh, that's where the sonic screwdriver wound up.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I don't have anything because I've been too busy watching all these shows.
That's right, that's right. It's been quite a big week. We had several shows that were starting back up for their season, even this late in the fall. And more importantly, they were all hitting one of the busiest fall seasons that we've had in years. Not only that, but what's funny is that we were all looking at the fall season and says, there's not that much new to worry about. We should have a pretty calm fall. And then we said, oh, Lord, they're rolling everything out all at the same time. This week is packed, and that's even with us dropping two shows off of our list because nobody was watching the shows anymore. So bye-bye to Gotham and Blindspot. Sorry, you were at the bottom of the list too often, but that doesn't really bode well for some of these other shows that are perennially at the bottom. We'll see how long they last. But yeah, this was a huge week. I think we had 24 episodes covered in some way, shape, or form. And yeah, it should have been...
Oh, I couldn't even get to some of the ones, and I did want to see them. I just couldn't squeeze them in.
Yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to things calming down with, you know, some of these shows hitting a hiatus or ending soon, whatever you want to call it. But something, some kind of relief. All right, so let's just go ahead and get right into it after Edmund gives his disclaimer.
Yes, as ever, we will talk about whatever we feel like talking about. So yes, if you haven't watched these, you might be spoiled. But we hope you've caught up. However large a crimp in your schedule that might have taken you.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I just want to point out as we start off this week that the episodes ranged anywhere from a 7.0, so dead average, as the lowest, all the way up to a 9.4. So everything that we have here is in some way, shape, or form average or above. Nothing fell on the below average scale. So it's all relative, right? So when we talk about these three shows that wound up at the bottom of the list, they are all in the average range, definitely. And we're going to start off here with a show that has come back from it, for its second season, and that is coming in at a 7.25, The Librarians, Season 2, Episodes 1 and 2, entitled And the Drowned Book and the Broken Staff. After being on their own for months, the Librarians gather together to investigate a mysterious and massive storm that has planted itself over Manhattan. Prospero conjures other fictionals, and the Librarians are soon pitted against Frankenstein's monster and Sherlock Holmes' adversary Moriarty. Meanwhile, Flynn and Baird clash over how to proceed against Prospero. Yes, so apparently Prospero, villain.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And as I said, this came in at an average of 7.25, and I personally felt that it was kind of dead average, but that's, again, it was a packed week. I don't know that my brain was really ready for them to come back yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think for, I mean, I upticked slightly to the 7.5, but I think that was just because I was really taken with this this introduction of the concept of the fictionals. Certainly for a show called The Librarians, the idea of being able to basically pull out any significant literary character you want and bring them to the screen as a potential adversary, or I imagine down the line possibly even collaborators and allies. I could see that happening. I thought it was a very nice twist. My biggest reservation with the show continues to be the one that I've had all along, that I never really watched the original movies, so I wasn't really sort of up on this Flynn Carson character, and apparently I believe they're basically playing him as he was in the movies, and I just find him to be too over the top and annoying, and I hope that they get back to what they were doing in the first season of getting back to the classic team, because that's where I can get it is the same people who are behind Leverage, and so aside from the cast similarities with Christian Kane, I would be happy to see that team starting continuing to build up its rapport and abilities, and if Noah Wiley wants to just stick around behind the scenes and just pop his head in occasionally, that would be perfectly fine with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I it was a perfectly good return. It just wasn't, blowing me away, unfortunately, with so much else going on.
Yeah.
Coming in at an average of 7.17, we have Heroes Reborn, Season 5, Episode 7, June 13th, Part 1. Noah seeks answers, teaming up with Hiro Nakamura to return to the tragic day that set everything in motion. Meanwhile, Mohinder Suresh receives a dire message about Erica's true motives. A calculated move is made against Hiro. Luke and Joanne seek a cure for their son. And as I said, this one came in at an average of 7.17. And I thought it was a pretty good first start to this or first part.
Yeah, I certainly, I mean, I've been rather lukewarm on the series and was considering dropping it until I realized that, no, obviously they everything they intended, this whole opening section to lead up to this big return to the events of Edessa. So I figured I should at least give them the benefit of the doubt to see if what they were leading all this up to. And yeah, I was, since a 7 for me was again an uptick from the previous week, previous weeks. I was very pleasantly surprised that they were able to take all of these elements that they'd currently been setting up and then weave them into the returning characters. For a show that often seemed to have in its original incarnation had some pretty extreme problems with plotting and consistency, they actually managed to weave this together I wouldn't say hugely well, but convincingly enough. Cautious optimism that they seem to be leading up to a good place, and then we now, of course, we just need to see if all these machinations and time loops they've set up actually lead to something satisfying.
Yeah, I know that it kind of took a little bit of a skid, but I have been enjoying it. And again, if it wasn't for the fact that there were all these other shows on at the same time, I'd probably appreciate it just a little bit more. But I know that even Bronstein was saying that he went into it and he felt like it was kind of really not hitting any of the good notes, and he felt like it was just going to turn out to be another episode that he wasn't going to appreciate. And then he got to the end and he found himself really wondering how they were going to get out of all this.
Yes,
it's exactly. Like, yeah, that's that's the point. There is some good here, even if it is a fairly average show overall. We are getting something out of it. All right, and speaking of average, unfortunately, the show at the bottom of our list here is Sleepy Hollow, Season 3, Episode 5, Dead Men Tell No Tales. The FBI is flummoxed by a strange death, but Abby and Ichabod search for supernatural reasons to make their case to Dr. Temperance Jones Brennan and Agent Seeley Booth. Meanwhile, Pandora resurrects a British general, and the town is threatened by an army of undead soldiers. It sounds like it should all be fun, right?
Yeah.
It was awkward.
Yes.
Really, really awkward. Not the least of the fact that I still remember David Boreanaz as Angel, and he does not look like that anymore.
Well, yes. Well, he has been doing that other show, and even though you just renamed her to Jones, that other show called Bones. But
yes. Did I?
Yes, you did.
I didn't mean to. That tells you everything that you need to know about my watching of Bones.
Yes.
Or the lack thereof. So anyhow. Yes, it was perfectly acceptable. It had its Ichabod moments, which are the only reason that I really watch Sleepy Hollow anymore, but it was an awkward and very forced crossover. Mm. You could kind of tell. And it wasn't the crossover in the sense of that started in one show's episode and then concluded here. No, it was two separate stories that just happened to have the characters from the other show interweave into the story. And I guess it was to introduce the characters to people who watched the two shows. And I really found no reason to watch Bones after seeing this. So, yeah.
Oh, well.
Yes. I just feel like Ichabod should show up on every show, though. So, that's just me. I just love the character. But unfortunately, it did come in at the bottom of our list. So that means that we can now switch over to our top three. And boy, do we have some interesting choices this time around. There was an episode that just missed the top three. I was really expecting it to go over the edge, but it didn't. But there we are. But, yeah. Number three, and this one coming in at an 8.75, The Leftovers, Season 2, Episode 5, No Room at the Inn. Matt and Mary leave Miracle to see if they can learn more about her condition, but their lives are turned upside down when they're not allowed back into town and must deal with the mob of desperate squatters that lingers just outside the gates.
Yes, indeed.
That doesn't even start.
No.
Oh, Christopher for Exelston, who did you piss off in the writer's room? Honestly. This was just brutal to watch, but fascinating at the same time. And, excuse me, that might be the perfect way to summarize The Leftovers this season. Really, in general.
Mm-hmm.
But this season, it has just been really, tough to watch at times. And this episode was a perfect example of that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's continuing their I guess what's now becoming the tradition. Last season, Christopher Eccleston had his sort of spotlight episode, and certainly this was his episode this time. And I mean, but I did like the way they were using it both to expand the let us know more about the machinations of Miracle and this huge camp of people trying to get in that was just outside the gates, certainly the way they introduced the twists, just turned it into to such a tortured journey. Certainly we'd already heard Matt's story of Mary magically awakening when they got there, and being awake for a few hours, and in that earlier episode where it wasn't made explicit, but there was certainly the implication there that that yes, they might have had sex when during those few hours, which then becomes the sort of fulcrum around which much of the action takes place when they take her for these tests, and she is pregnant, but catatonic, and of course nobody really believed his story that they're sure it's all in his head, so the amount of moral indignation and resistance that he then gets both from the hospital and then of course from Mr. Self-Righteous himself, John, back in town. It was just a horribly wrenching way to get them into that situation, because certainly the way it opened, when it seems like yes, their wristbands got stolen, which was very nasty sequence. One of those where all the viewers are seeing it coming, but of course poor old Matt, being a little too trusting, a little too naive, lets them get into that situation, and an incredibly powerful performances, yeah, I mean, it's as you say, John. I mean, it's been a strange season with the way they have upped the surreal factor by placing it in this Texas town. Certainly it's again like last season, is still very compelling to watch given the quality of the performances and the writing that's going on, I do have to mention that I do have to give credit to the producers, because the whole repent stocks that Matt does wind up putting himself in, with the full frontal nudity that is allowed from on premium cable, is what they started calling as the sonic screwdriver moment at the end there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just the whole thing. It really comes down to, and maybe I'm just forgetting, but have we ever had any definitive reason to believe that she was awake? Because that's the part that really kind of freaks me out. Because there's indications throughout that he's imagining she's awake.
Yes.
And then therefore you just assume, that's what's going on. And that's really nasty.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in keeping with the character's desperation, which, again, The Leftovers, welcome to nothing but characters in desperation that you can't stop watching. It was really well done. You never quite knew where you stood. I love the fact that there's little things that are being hinted about the characters that still to this moment you don't know exactly the full picture of, say, John and why he's got what secret he has or secrets he has and everything else that's going on. We're halfway through the season and I still feel like we're barely scratching the surface. So it's not an easy show to watch, but it is a compelling show to watch. And this was one of the better ones.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. And Gary, why don't you take the next one here?
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about Manhattan, season 2, episode 4, Overlord. Oppenheimer puts Charlie in a precarious position. That does, as you said in the previous one, this description doesn't even begin to cover this show. I felt they could have broken this show into probably 2 to 3 episodes, and I still would have been happy with all of them. This came in at a 9.33. Things are moving ahead, and I love how they're starting to throw even more history into it. I'm always a big history nut, and I feel not only are they throwing it in there, but they're generally getting it right, which is always a nice thing to happen when they introduce these sort of quasi historical television shows. There's so much happening here. Oppenheimer's cheating on his wife with a mistress who has communist ties. The main character, Frank, all of a sudden shows up at the end of the episode, sort of out of the blue. There's issues going on with the bomb getting dropped. You have several personal issues going on. And it's just it feels like they're juggling like about 4 to 5 balls at the same time, and you can't help but watch. It's really enjoyable. So for this episode, I'd still have to say I enjoyed the I guess the soap opera dynamic, so to speak, of Oppenheimer's mistress sort of being discovered and sort of played out and even taunted on Oppenheimer by Charlie's wife. So, but it was done in a sort of an enjoyable way. But at the same time, you always have security issues and things like that in this show that always sort of pop up to stifle someone or stop a certain line of thought or put danger into the situation. Edmund, I know you're a big fan of the show too. What stuck with you about this episode?
Yeah, well, I found fascinating, I mean, it was as well as you, is the way they've been playing those personal dynamics, the conflicts with Charlie having been placed in this position in the first place of having to lie about Frank's whereabouts and try and lead the team, and Oppenheimer being distracted and off in San Francisco, and so Rachel, his wife, trying to push him to take Oppenheimer's job, but then the way they played it out, because these are scientists and analytical people, and the way they were then going through and analyzing it and realizing that the only reason why that this project is staying on track is because of Oppenheimer and his unique abilities to cajole and interface with the military and even the local officials. When there's this problem of with the local judges they're actually trying to get the land on which to do the Trinity test, and of course Oppenheimer is the one who our top three so far does seem to be somewhat revolving around certain anatomies, but finding out that yes, he likes gelding horses, literally gelding horses, throwing out these things that might make you a little uncomfortable, but that's the reason why General Groves put Oppenheimer in charge, which is very true to the real life. And so having this potential coup turn into, no, wait a minute, we have to figure out how to keep Oppenheimer in the job because he's really looking to bolt. It was compelling to watch, but I also found it rather chilling the way they introduced this element of Jean, Oppenheimer's mistress, did in fact commit suicide at this time. One thing I found intriguing is because the note she left was unsigned, which they was actually something that they did just very briefly show on camera. Over the years there had actually been all sorts of speculation of that there had been some sort of foul play, and that perhaps the military had taken her out to get her out of the way and keep Oppenheimer where he was. But then to have that conversation with Charlie's wife, essentially, seeming to kind of goad her into it, I thought was a brilliant melding of the real life stuff going on with the behind the scenes speculation that actually blend, basically merge perfectly with the fictional characters and setup that they've created on the Hill. So I thought it was just a pretty amazing mix of I wouldn't say accuracy, but fidelity to history, and some really compelling drama as well.
Yeah, I unfortunately had missed a couple episodes and had to kind of get myself back on track with them. But yeah, the Gene, I guess, was the one that was the character that really had me just spellbound in this episode from the beginning. Just her kind of, I guess it's not unique, but her brand of insanity and the way that she had Oppenheimer just wrapped around her finger was really interesting to me. And just the way that it's been affecting him and his performance on the job. And yeah, I'm kind of glad that I was able to get back into the series because it's one of those ones where you don't think about it, at least I don't think about it immediately as the go-to show for the week. But it's kind of got that dark horse thing going on with it where it is, once you start watching it, you just can't stop. It really is quite compelling. And that character in particular and her fate in this episode was really well interwoven into everything else that was going on.
Yeah,
from my perspective.
Yeah, and also, I mean, John, when you're mentioning about how Jean's wrapping him around her finger, I mean, that was just the other element that I've found very intriguing is that we're now four episodes in, and one thing they've done very well is building up the female characters the fact that everything you were just talking about in terms of the hold the mistress has on him, the fact that his wife is well aware of it, really building up this element of yes, we're in the 40s, we're in the war, the men are nominally in charge, but the old adage about behind every great man is a great or greater woman is certainly being illustrated here. It was this episode in particular where I started, it's not as good a show as this, but there's a certain similarity to what was going on with Halt and Catch Fire, where they realized in case of that show how much more interesting the female characters were, and giving them a lot more play and a lot more focus. And here I'd say that there's a little bit more equality between the sexes, but it's certainly nice to see it's not just the guys who are the geniuses and movers and shakers, and if anything, it's the women who are doing their best to keep things moving and keep things going as they should.
Yeah, they're definitely breaking them out of stereotypes a bit and making them actual fleshed out characters, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. So, anything else that you guys want to bring up? Again, this came in at a 9.33. It's a pretty good showing for this, and Manhattan has been up towards the top of the list pretty much since it came back.
Oh, I'm glad they did finally bring Frank back. I enjoy him in the mix, and having him out of the mix seemed sort of like the show was crippled, but at the same time, it's nice to see a show where they can pull the main character and still have it thrive, so, and they've been doing that, but I'm glad to have him back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, as their analysis of the team showed, it's they do work better when everybody's there.
Yes, indeed. It was a nice place to end the episode, for sure. All right, well, that having been said, we are going to move into the show that edged out Manhattan for the number one slot, and this was a big episode, and I'm actually quite pleased by the reaction to it. I was a little bit worried that it would be more middle ground, but it seems like everybody really took to this one, and that is The Walking Dead, Season 6, Episode 4, Here's Not Here. A new face is introduced, and people question who can be trusted and who can change. Is that what you're going to say for this one? All right.
Okay. Well, it is AMC, so.
Yes. No. 9.4 being the score for this one. And Flacco Jones over at Vogue said, loved the episode, and Eastman especially. As much as Morgan's decisions have bothered me a bit, it's nice to see things from his point of view now. Still, it seems like there needs to be some sort of happy medium between Eastman's way and Rick's way, because sometimes there is pure evil like Eastman's nemesis and the wolves. Yeah, and yeah. I bet they're going to, potentially run into somebody like that sooner or later. Possibly.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe. But until that happens, boy, this one was a... I gave it a 9, but it was only because of some slight reservations, and kind of looking back on it, I easily could have given it a 9.5 or a 10. I think I was giving them a little bit of room to maneuver throughout the rest of the season, because this season, holy cow, this season. But wow, what a treatise. Gary, why don't you go ahead and get us started here?
Well, I want to say, I guess you would say this was Eastman's episode, more so than anyone else's. But at the same time, it was nice to, see the development of the character and see how he got to this point where we, where he was sort of had this pacifist stance and we almost couldn't understand it even when the wolves were attacking. Why isn't he fighting back harder? Why does he want to kill? Why is he letting the guys run away? And we finally got our answer to this. And part of this, I think, what made us enjoyed this so much was that we've become attached to the character previously. When he was left and left so broken the last time we had run across him, everybody, at least I did, I sort of, really felt sorry for him and wondered what was going to happen to him. And, and we got to see what happened to him, how he got pulled back out of that hole that we already knew he was, that he was deep in. And so it was almost like I almost call it a redemption story, which I think helped raise my opinion of it above and beyond just the actual show itself. And that you like to see that people save themselves or pull themselves up. And that's what we got to see in this episode. And that's what I'm taking away from it the most. Did I miss not seeing the other characters? No, I really did. I can't say I didn't, because it was such a strong storyline. Sometimes when they do these sort of flashbacks or side stories, they don't always do them well, but they really excelled this time around. And I wish they would do another story this well, and not just and not so poorly. This did not feel like a filler episode to me, the way some of the offshoots typically do.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's exactly the point, is that it could have felt like something that was just disconnected. And we've seen this a couple seasons now, right? I think we saw that with the governor's backstory. Mm-hmm. It felt a little disconnected. We saw it with Beth and her side story last season. This felt like it belonged. And it felt like it belonged because there's so much emphasis right now on Rick's philosophy and how they're trying to survive in Alexandria, that this being, the genesis of where Morgan's philosophy stands, it made sense to explore that. And in one episode, for Eastman to basically come out of nowhere and become easily one of the best guest characters that has ever been on this show. I mean, come on. That was just amazing. And it's – I said this in my review, and it's one of those things that kind of sticks out to me, is that we spend an entire 90-minute episode, extended episode, on Eastman and his philosophy and convincing Morgan to go down this path and become a better person, even though he still struggles with it. And at the end of the day, you still in the back of your mind go, yeah, but is that practical? Is it all for naught? Because it works great when you're in a cabin by yourself in the middle of nowhere. They're in the middle of a metro area. Is that going to work? Because even if you can adopt that philosophy with one other person or with the undead, the way that he did, as soon as you've got marauding bands of people, it's going to break down. And I feel like the end of this episode left you with this feeling like Morgan's trying to live up to this philosophy is going to come back to bite everybody, literally, perhaps. So I felt like it really had this nice little hint of darkness at the end of it along the way. How about you guys?
I want to just make sure we give due credit to John Carroll Lynch, who played Eastman, and of course Lenny James, is as we always love, as Morgan, but certainly having the two of them butting heads with each other and eventually coming to this accommodation was just a marvelous thing to see, and of course certainly couldn't help feeling a little foreshadowed. Given the way Eastman went out to the walker that Morgan hadn't taken out earlier, it seemed like a bit of a backhanded critique along the lines you were talking of, John. That this doesn't necessarily always work the way you want it to. But the other thing I wanted to mention was you brought up the length, John, and this was the first time that I felt that the Walking Dead had actually justified the extended time with the material to support it. The previous longer episodes, both of them wound up feeling stretched out and didn't really need to be 90 minutes. So, this one, we definitely needed to take that journey, and trying to do it in the regular 60 would not have worked. Certainly the one thing we haven't brought up at all, because obviously it didn't really bother any of us. Certainly not Bronze Thumb, since he gave it a 10 among our 9s and 9.5s, really didn't matter to me that I didn't get to find out yet what happened to Glenn, but that's partially because whichever way it is, I'm not really necessarily looking forward to the way they resolve that, or haphazardly resolve it, or whatever winds up happening in next week, or maybe the week after, or whenever they decide to actually let us know.
Yeah, I suppose that's one way of looking at it. I don't know. Gary, anything else to say about this particular episode?
Well, I also like the fact that Eastman wasn't just sort of talking the talk. You know, we got to really see his story lay out, you know, as he told us that, and you know, even as he mentioned it, I was like, oh gee. I was watching this episode with my wife, and we were going back and forth as to whether or not we were going to see the guy that he was talking about, see his grave in those plots. And sure enough, we did, which was sort of nice. And he explains how he came to believe his philosophy, that he wasn't just something he didn't believe with his heart, and obviously he paid for it with his life. But I enjoyed that sort of nice twist that you started to wonder his motivations, even though he was saying one thing, was he really thinking another? So I like that. I like that we got to find out his truth before he was killed off, and it wasn't left as a lingering plot line.
Hmm. Yeah, it was a nice, relatively complete tale. Let's put it that way. And that's how I looked at it and why I think it worked for me. If it had been something that was like, oh no, we're going to stretch this over three episodes, it might have been something else. But the fact that you had closure on Eastman and Morgan's time with him, I think, really made a big difference. And that's probably why it's up at the top of our list this week. So, yes, that's our bottom and top choices. So we're going to go ahead and move right into the rest of the week. And we'll start off with the show that just missed being in the top three. And I think that just one little tweak here or there might have made the difference. It might have been Bronstum's score that made the difference here. And that would be Doctor Who, Series 9, Episode 7, The Zygon Invasion. Shape-shifting aliens kidnap Osgood and the Doctor. Clara and UNIT travel the world to find Earth. And again, that description doesn't even... This one came in at an 8.63. And I have to say, for me at least, I really enjoyed this one. It was a really good first part of a story. Gary, how about you? You also give it a 9.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it a lot. I honestly don't like the trappings of UNIT as much as some people might. I enjoy the sort of world domination story, but the UNIT format just doesn't quite work for me. But I realize it's a callback to several other Doctors,
yes.
And I can respect that. So I was okay with it. But
remember,
it really
don't go dissing UNIT too much. Pertwee was my childhood Doctor.
Anyway, I prefer when the Doctor relies on himself a bit more, perhaps. That being said, it didn't hurt my enjoyment, but I felt I probably would have gone up higher if it wasn't quite that much. But I enjoy these classic Doctor has to save the world type of storylines, or at least a large number of people. It seems to hike the tension for me, and I enjoy when the Doctor seems to struggle rather than sort of walk through an episode. And while again. Capaldi still not in my top 10 of favorite Doctors. I enjoyed him a bit more in this one than in some of the previous episodes this season. It just when more's on the line, the Doctor seems to thrive a bit more. So I enjoyed it a lot. The Clara twist at the end was quite interesting and leaves me a little bit nervous, actually. So well done.
Yeah, it was really good getting to see Jenna do something a little bit different, huh? Get a little bit dark, get a little bit nasty.
Yes.
Calm down, John. Calm down.
I'm just saying it was different.
Yes.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
Look, I'm not Brad from Pod Culture, okay? So, but yes, it was not Clara. Let's put it that way. And what really I found interesting was that it came right on the heels of everything that Ashinder said last episode about how the Doctor and the choices that he makes they have consequences that not everybody or that he never really thinks through, and somebody's got to be there to hold him accountable, and then this happens. So
yeah, also one thing I found intriguing was I don't recall the Doctor Who stories being quite so topical and relevant. I mean, the fact that they look like they were virtually using stock footage of some of these refugee crises that are going on, particularly around the Middle East and Europe right now, and certainly all of the issues of prejudice and bigotry that they were bringing up,
thinking back on those on those original unit stories, as I mentioned, I was just a kid, so I was not only was too young to remember, was also probably too young to pick up on any of that if it was going on. But John, having been through them more recently, in any of those Third Doctor stories, were you aware of them sort of trying to hitting on topical subjects, or was this something that felt a little newer and more unique?
No, to be honest with you, I think that that's exactly the point that they were making in the Third Doctor era and unit, was trying to have some of that social commentary that had become so popularized by, say, Star Trek, but then also to really get away from the monotony of the kind of like, oh, look, there's a base, and it's being attacked. That was the kind of Second Doctor thing. But the Third Doctor, no, they had some pretty topical, especially that first year. As I'm remembering, was it Liz Shaw that was the companion at the time?
Yes.
And yeah, I remember that those were very down to earth, no pun intended, stories. And this felt very Third Doctor, with perhaps the budget of the 12th Doctor, but it felt very, very much in keeping with that kind of, we're going to explore this whole idea of this, you know, I alluded to, it was the same paranoia that you got from Battlestar Galactica and the Cylons.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Let's see. So, Gary, anything more to say about this particular episode?
No. I thought the Zygon's costumes are still a little bit cheesy, but that's okay. I was okay with it.
Yeah, I've always felt that that's their own little tongue-in-cheek homage to the rubber suit era. Speaking of old Who again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did. It did allude to that for sure. Okay, and Edmund, if you don't mind taking the next one.
Certainly. This was The Good Wife, Season 7, Episode 5, Payback. Jason uses aggressive investigative tactics when he assists Alicia and Luca with a student loan case. Meanwhile, Howard Lyman alleges ageism at his firm and accuses Carrie as the primary defender, and Eli stirs up floric family drama on Peter's presidential campaign. And Nadim gave this an 8.5 and says, another week, another delightfully crafty episode from The Good Wife. Not quite sure what they were crafting, but Nadim seemed to like it.
Yes, indeed. And okay, then, from there we have another big episode to talk about here, and this would be Arrow, Season 4, Episode 4, Beyond Redemption. Laurel deals with the repercussions of taking Sarah to Nanda Parbat. Meanwhile, Oliver asks Captain Lance for a favor and is surprised at what he finds out. And this one came in at an average of 8.42. And Henry says, I have to give the show its due credit in setting up this conflict between Oliver and Captain, codenamed Detective Lance, slowly through the paces of 3+ seasons, then committing to turning the tables with it and not making it look like it comes out of left field. That's a good point. And then Nadim, who gave it a 9, said, superbly written and thrillingly plotted, Beyond Redemption is a standout hour of Arrow. So lots of good things being said here. And Gary, you gave it a pretty good score as well.
Oh yeah, I mean this series is doing really well for me. I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it a lot. The idea that that Lance is maybe not playing both sides, but realizes he's in too deep, detective. This is really an enjoyable thing, and I feel like the actor is really thriving on the role right now. This whole idea that he's actually going to work and set up Damian Dark is nice. I like it. I like also how Diggle's sort of coming back around again. He's, you know, he's still been at an arm's length since Ollie came back into the picture, but I feel now like he's sort of starting to accept him again and work with him, which is nice, even though we're finding out more and more revelations that seem to be going the other way for him. Everyone else seems to be jiving and, you know, working really hard, even though this is failing. We also get the announcement of, I believe in this episode, about him running for mayor or starting his campaign more fully. And that's an interesting twist as well. I guess, you know, he's a known name in the city, but the way that the city just seems to be falling apart, I'm surprised he's finding as many people to sort of work with him as he would like. So, you know, it's this one thing where they're showing the city breaking down, people are leaving, everything's falling apart, yet he's finding people to you know, stand up for his campaign and things like that. I find it interesting. I just feel that they've made the city appear so horrible that it's almost hard to believe that that type of environment is still functioning to actually have him run a campaign. So I think they've done such a good job of destroying this, or saying the city's going downhill, that it's hard for me to follow up with, oh, okay, so he's going to run for mayor and he can get some people to back him and everything's going to start turning around. It just, I think they swung so much one way that it's hard for me to believe the other.
Yeah, although I almost get the impression that things have just gotten so bad. I mean, I think they've done a decent job of sort of setting up this dynamic that nobody really wants the job, since they seem to be unlikely to survive it. So in that regard, I think it works that Ollie could step in and make a run at this.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that it's an interesting direction for them to go, but I do think that there are some elements that are still a little bit too much set up for Legends of Tomorrow, and I feel like that's something that is that, you know, Bronstein brought up a lot last time, and that has been brought up a few times, that they're spending time in both shows in the DCW setting up Legends of Tomorrow, and it's a little blatant. So certainly Sarah's resurrection is written up at the top of the list.
Oh, I agree with you. I wish they would have one more crossover and get all this material just burned through so that they can keep going. It's not quite a backdoor pilot, but at the same time, geez, they're squeezing a lot of it. You're right. It's you can see it in the script and wonder, oh, how could this script work otherwise? Now, I do have to admit the whole Lance saga is sort of meshed into Arrow a little bit better than, say, the Firestorm or some of the other characters are, but it's still that they're focusing so much time on it that it's sort of blatantly obvious what they're doing.
Yeah, that's pretty much where my head was going with it too, and it does take a little bit off the top, but still, it's coming in pretty well above average, so can't complain too much about it. I will be happy when it's over, and they can just tell their own story, though. That would be good. Moving on then to the next show on the list, which is Supernatural Season 11, Episode 4, Baby, seen entirely from the point of view of the Impala. Sam and Dean go on a road trip to fight monsters and demons. And guess what? It actually worked because it came in at an average of 8.33. Yes. And Bronstein, this is easily the best score he's given the show in
long time.
Seasons. Yes. So was so enjoyable.
Oh, geez, I might have to watch that, as my daughter has a copy of their Impala sitting next to her bed.
Nah, definitely, man.
Team Free Will. Woo! All right. This was just a great episode, and I'm gonna be honest, the monster thing isn't in the case itself was not what made this one. It was the character beats that you got to see, you know, them singing in the car, them just hanging out because they have to sleep in the car. Just, you know, the little nuances of the characterization really was hearkening back to some of the earlier seasons in some really nostalgic ways that I just enjoyed the heck out of.
Yeah, I think this was a perfect case of even though, you know, yes, I've only watched the second half of the series, you know, but I've seen enough of their work with meta episodes that this writer's room, you know, however much people may shift in and out of it, it's like, yeah, when they get to go a little tongue in cheek and self-referential, it just always seems to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was just I cringed when I saw the description. And I was like, please tell me it's not going to be that. It's not going to be like just weird camera angles the entire time.
Right.
And it wasn't. It was just a little bit of a storytelling, you know, device to have the quote unquote point of view always be somehow from the car. And it was neat, but it wasn't that distracting. It's not like the one fun part was when the valet girl stole the car for a joyride. That was the one time you're like, what is going on here? But it was hilarious. The whole way through. And then how little things like that happened in the car that you like normally would never see factored into the conclusion of the whole story, which, yeah, it's, that stuff was the fun stuff. That's what I like to see. And yeah, this season, I'm not going to say is like knocking it out of the park, but this is probably the best season we've had in a while, at least from a start.
Yeah.
I mean, these four episodes. So, all right. Then moving on here to another part of the DCW. And that would be The Flash, Season 2, Episode 5, The Darkness and the Light. Barry learns a new Breacher, Dr. Light, has come through the portal and sets off to capture her. During a fight with The Flash, she blinds him and drops some shocking news about Zoom. Meanwhile, Barry and Patty go out on a date. Those are more interconnected than you think they are.
Yes,
in hilarious ways. This came in at an average of 8.3. And Henry says, most people are going to think the episode is a bit too overstuffed with the introduction of new characters, is set up for Legends of Tomorrow, and building up more of the universe. But the pacing keeps it from being bogged down by the material. Yes, he gave this one a higher grade than he did Arrow. And so did you, Gary.
Oh, yeah. No, I liked it a lot. And I enjoyed the Dr. Light characterization, both from the way that she was Linda Park's alternate reality person, and they used that effectively to their success. But also, I had a feeling like Dr. Light wasn't quite the heartless. Well, not that she was a great person, but you really had more of a sense that she's sort of forced into this. That Zoom is really manipulating her as well, and she's as stuck in some ways as Team Flash is, with Zoom, that she's forced to do it or else was the sort of feeling I got. And I didn't quite have that from the other characters that have been introduced. So I enjoyed that. As far as Barry and Patty going out on a date, I liked it. The actors seem to play off each other really well, and I like it. And please don't let Patty be evil. Please don't let Patty be evil. Anyway, that was nice. We're also sort of, fleshing out Zoom a lot more. So that's nice. I enjoyed both Jay's sort of description of him, but then Wells's interplay with Jay was very interesting, and how he was painting Jay almost as a coward to some extent, even though Jay was defending himself against it. But you get the sense that Jay was out of his league or outclassed by Zoom for whatever reason, be his intelligence or his speed. And it was an interesting interchange. We think Jay is this super heroic guy, but at the same time, Wells was calling him to task in some very unkind ways, and Jay was not quite denying them. So I wonder if we'll see more of that sort of description or examples of what Wells was describing.
Mm. Yeah, I particularly liked Tom Cavanaugh getting to come in and give us this more obnoxious version of the Harrison Wells character. Even though we got that brief glimpse of our Earth's Harrison Wells conversion episode last season, to have him come back and we're now it's the same body, turns out that the Earth 2 version just really, as Sisko said, is a dick.
I'm surprised that made television that word.
Yeah, so. but I really like that dynamic. That yes, he's supposedly a good guy, but certainly Jay doesn't like what he's been doing, and even the little bits and pieces we've seen from Earth 2, it's a it's a very interesting introduction of bringing the villain back, but getting to do new twists on him. And no, I don't trust him at all, obviously, since I'm lumping him in with villains.
Why would you?
Yes.
That's foolish. The Flash this season is really building on what they did last time. And last season, the first season was already good enough. I mean, this is really just doubling down on it. I think it's just these little connections to Legends of Tomorrow that occasionally get in the way. But at the same time, you know what? We haven't seen what it's going to look like when the three shows are operating together. And it could be that this is setting things up in such a way that it makes sense for there to be kind of cross-pollination of storytelling and of characters that will be really good when you see it play out. We're still kind of on the fence because we haven't seen what that means yet, I think. But at any rate, I think what we're going to do is go ahead and wrap up this episode here. We'll continue with the episodic discussion next time, and then whatever time we have left, we'll do some open topics, and that'll be it for this week. So, next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review. So let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under the Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.